It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickard is off today. Coming up later in the show, what should the United States do with the 57,000 migrant youths that have been taken into custody at the border with Mexico since October? Madison and Milwaukee have been suggested as potential places to temporarily house at least some of them. We'll hear from the mayors of both of those cities. First, it was 200 years ago today that American and British forces clashed on Wisconsin soil, fighting for control of the American-held Fort Shelby and the surrounding area of Prairie du Chien. It was the only battle of that war to be fought on Wisconsin soil, the War of 1812. Although the British won the fight, they'd ultimately lose the territory later in the war. Joining us now to tell us more about the Battle of Prairie du Chien and how its 200th anniversary is being observed is Susan Kaya Slusser. She's site director for Villa Louis Historic Site in Prairie du Chien. Susan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
So let's start with some of the basics here. What was the importance of Prairie du Chien in the context of the War of 1812?
Well, what's important about Prairie du Chien is that this was, you know, the center for the fur trade in the upper Mississippi River Valley. And what it comes down to for this battle, it comes down to the control of the fur trade. And the current residents of Prairie du Chien in 1814 were really sympathetic with the British, and that's who they were trading with out of Canada. And American forces come up from St. Louis wanting to start really putting an American influence on these residents of Prairie du Chien. And so led by Governor Clark from the Lewis and Clark fame, comes up from St. Louis and decides that this is the perfect location for a military station. And so they build Fort Shelby in June of 1814, and the British are not too happy about that.
And so what's the British response?
The British response, they start gathering forces. They are coming down from Canada. They start gathering with voyageurs, you know, whose, you know, whole economy is and their survival is on the fur trade. But they also gather Native American forces. And so they gather all these people with some British militia. They come down from Mackinac, and they kind of sneak up on the Americans. They set up camp just south of where we sit today. And while the Americans are getting ready to go out for a Sunday carriage ride on July 17, 1814, they sight the British, and not only British, but all of the Native Americans, and they go back to the fort, and that's when the battle begins.
Now, before we get to the battle itself, these are, in some ways, as you've described it, very informal armies. These are not people raised, for the most part, by the government in uniforms, I'm guessing. These are almost militias.
There are militias. There are infantrymen, but there are some. You will see some military presence if you come to our battle reenactment, but they start just mustering in just your average folks who are really scraping together an existence here on what is currently the frontier of the Old Northwest. And some of the residents of Prairie du Chien, it wasn't until after this war in 1816 that the residents of Prairie du Chien finally raised the first American flag. And there were some consequences to this. For the residents of Prairie du Chien that decided to side with the British because that's where they were making their livelihood with the fur trade, some of them go back to Canada, some of them leave and go off to the Red River settlement. And once more American influence comes into Prairie du Chien, some of the sympathizers, they have land taken away. So there's lasting effects of this battle, although it's, you know, kind of misunderstood. People don't understand why we're celebrating the bicentennial of the War of 1812 and 1814, but indeed, we did have the only battle here in Wisconsin on our property, and it's an important layer of our history.
And tell us a little bit about the battle. It was not a huge battle and no deaths, as I understand it.
No, there were no actual casualties. What had happened is they were right in the middle of summer. It was July of 1814. The Americans that were at Fort Shelby, a lot of them had family with them. It was just a small garrison. The well runs dry. They start running out of supplies, and the Americans realize they're not going to win this. And the British, they come down from Mackinac, they didn't have a lot of supplies as well. And as they're volleying these shots back and forth, cannonballs don't explode. They run out and grab them and fire them back at the other side. Eventually, the Americans run out of supplies. They give up, get back onto the boats, and go down to St. Louis. The British take over Fort Shelby, rename it Fort Mackay after the lieutenant colonel in charge of their forces, and stay in Prairie du Chien until May of 1815. Not realizing that the British had already lost the War of 1812.
Well, kind of like the most famous battle of the War of 1812, the Battle of New Orleans, which was fought after, I think, one of the main treaties was signed, but word did not travel fast there. So the British ruled in Prairie du Chien in the interim.
They did, and they did not treat some of the residents of Prairie du Chien very well. So, like I said, there were consequences, and it just isn't—it's very important. And still, with many descendants of these people living in our community today, this means a lot to Prairie du Chien, and it means a lot to the state of Wisconsin.
And so now it's the anniversary. Today is the anniversary. You're doing a lot this weekend, I gather. What kind of remembrances, what kind of festivities are going on?
Yes, we have lots of activities taking place both days. Capped off on Saturday at 4 p.m., we actually reenact the battle. But what's really exciting about that is the reenactors are here, and we have a record number of reenactors coming this year because it is our bicentennial. But there'll be musket and cannon fire, and during the battle reenactment, we have pyrotechnic special effects that go off. But there's military camp life, there's civilian life, there's demonstration cooking, there's games for children from the period. We're going to be doing a bicentennial flag ceremony at 3:30 on Saturday. But even better than that, you know, we are located on one of the premier historic house museums in the country, the grounds of the Villa Louis. This happened right on our grounds. You can also tour our mansion as well. So there's all these different layers of history that you can take part of, and it looks like the weather's going to be good for us.
Yeah, so there's the grounds and the mansion. What else could we see at the Villa Louis site, even if we miss the events this weekend?
If you miss events this weekend, you can come out for a whole list of special events throughout the year. And we do have a fur trade museum that people can come to really get a sense of our early history. And there's always something taking place. We always have interpreters in period costuming, really able to take you back in time and share some of these great early stories with our visitors.
And are there any archaeological remnants of the original Fort Shelby / Fort McKay?
There are, and some people might have heard on the news. We actually just experienced a high water event, and we were having a planned archaeological dig. Unfortunately, that dig has been postponed until, I think, September. But yes, the WPA was here in the 1930s, and you can come and visit and see some archaeological remains of Fort Crawford. That's the fort that gets built in 1816, the Americans' response to the British coming to Prairie du Chien. So there's remnants of that. We have a restored blockhouse, which would have stood here in 1816. And so there are things you can take place. And Fort Shelby, we're still working on that. We have some archaeologists that we're working with to really exactly figure out where that site was located in relationship to where the Villa Louis Mansion sits today.
So you've explained why this event, this unique event, is important to Prairie du Chien. Should the rest of us in Wisconsin pay attention to this one-of-a-kind battle that was fought here?
It is. That's what's so great about this reenactment. You're actually going to experience history where it happened. That's why this is such a unique event. It's a wonderful event, and these reenactors come from all over the country. We have many people coming down from Canada, and they take the time out of their busy schedules to help us put on history and make it a hands-on living experience for people today.
Well, Susan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Susan Kaya-Sluser. She's site director for the Villa Louis Historic Site in Prairie du Chien. We continue our coverage of the influx of young migrants at the U.S. border with Mexico. Since October of last year, 57,000 unaccompanied children, mostly coming from Central America, have been taken into custody at the border. President Obama has called this influx a humanitarian crisis. He's asked for $3.7 billion to help deal with the issue. On Monday of this week, the first plane of children being deported back to Honduras landed in San Pedro Sula with aid workers waiting to meet them. With only 10 working days left before legislators in Washington leave for their August recess, politicians are scrambling to find a solution. Yesterday, we spoke with U.S. Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin. He's pushing for a broad-scale repatriation of the kids. Others would like to see them put up temporarily in cities around the U.S. while the federal government continues to seek a response. Madison and Milwaukee are two of the cities being considered. Some people welcome the idea. Some communities around the country have been protesting, saying we should take care of our own first, not encourage more people to come to the U.S. Here with us to talk about how communities around the country are responding to this issue is USA Today immigration reporter Alan Gomez. We'll also be speaking with Madison Mayor Paul Soglin, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett. Alan, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So at this point, before we get to this idea of housing these migrants at cities around the country, looking at the big picture, we've heard a lot of politicians offering different suggestions on how to manage the crisis at the border. Are there any leading likely proposals here?
It's suddenly everybody's filing a bill these last couple of days on trying to get a handle on this. But the main thing we need to be concentrating on, so the White House has proposed a $3.7 billion emergency funding request. About half of that is for caring for these kids while they're in the United States. But the other half is also to increase more border security and to get more immigration judges and prosecutors down to the border to speed it up. Now, what we do to, kind of address this more long-term, that's, I think, what these bills are aimed at. But they're kind of all over the place right now, and they only got a couple of weeks left before the August recess. So it's going to be hard for Congress to really get coalesce around one of these plans.
So as with a lot of things at the federal level, there may well be a short-term answer. A long-term answer remains elusive.
No, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, that $3.7 billion funding request from the White House, I mean, that's really what they're trying to get to right now. That's sort of to address the immediate needs. I mean, as we'll talk about, obviously, these kids, they just run out of places along the border to house them. So they're really scrambling to find where to put them. And so that comes under the Department of Health and Human Services. And so what they're trying to do is get about half that money, half that request, is for them to be able to either identify or purchase or lease out locations that are suitable for these kids to be able to house in. And then the other half is to, again, bring in, I think they estimate about 40 immigration judges down to that border to speed up the deportation so that kids start heading back to Central America so that parents down there quickly get that message, hey, if I send my kid on this incredibly dangerous journey, they might just be on the next plane flight back. So that's what they're trying to do to address this in the immediate short term. But then there are, again, all these other congressmen are starting to look at ways to further secure the border. There was a hearing today in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee about maybe sending more money down to these Central American countries where they're coming from, so to help them get better security, improve their economy, so that these people just don't feel that this is their only option.
So as you mentioned, there's a scramble to find places to at least temporarily house all these youth detained at the border. A lot of cities and towns around the country have been approached by the federal government about finding temporary housing. What places is the Department of Health and Human Services looking for?
Oh, man, they really, it's every day it's been hard to track how many places they're looking at because it's just such a high number. I'm down here in Miami. I can tell you that and this is an area that's pretty used to big influxes of immigrants, whether it's Cuban or Haitian. And so they had some facilities, so I can tell you that some of them are definitely going back there. But then aside from that, they're trying to really look all over the place. I mean, they've looked from Virginia to Massachusetts to Illinois to the West Coast and California. For a while there, the first response was to start using military facilities. So they used military bases in Texas, California, and Oklahoma, and they started sending kids there. The kids are obviously separated from the rest of the population there, but that was the very first fix. But then after that, they started looking at just really a wide range of options. They started looking at a former monastery in Illinois. They started looking at surplus government buildings in Virginia and Baltimore. It's been an incredibly mixed reaction once local politicians and once locals in those areas start hearing that some of these kids might be heading in their direction.
What has the response been from city officials? Mixed, positive, negative?
Well, it's if you judge from what you're seeing on TV right now, it's very negative. But no, I can tell you, it's been interesting. There's been some displays in California, for example. There's one area there, Murrieta, where a lot of people have been trying to actually block these buses from going to the Border Patrol stations over there. We saw a little bit of this as well in Arizona in the last couple of days in a city called Oracle, where a lot of people have been just going out on the road trying to literally block these buses from going to these facilities. We've seen smaller protests in Michigan where that was a possibility as well. But at the same time, we've also started seeing little by little some places just saying, hey, look, bring them here. Governor of Massachusetts, Governor Patrick over there, said just yesterday that he's more than willing to let some of these kids go over there and to open up some facilities in the state to allow for that. And quietly, I think we've seen that from some other places around the country. Obviously, if you're a politician and you stick your head up and say, hey, I'm willing to take these on, you're exposing yourself to to quite a lot of heat in this environment. But, you know, Health and Human Services has been quietly hearing from a lot of these places saying, look, we got some extra facilities. You know, we're happy to do it. And so it's kind of been a mixed bag so far.
And Alan, stand by. Earlier we talked to Madison Mayor Paul Soglin. Madison has been asked to house some of these kids. We asked him about the inquiry from the federal government that Madison housed about 250 of the kids.
Thank you.
So it's been reported that you've been approached by the federal government about temporarily housing some of these young migrants here in Madison. Is there any indication of how many kids and for how long?
The time frame is usually 30 to 60 days, which is how long it takes for the child to go before an administrator who will do, in effect, a hearing to see whether or not the child should stay in the U.S. or be deported. The facility is a self-contained facility, and all expenses and costs are handled by the federal government.
Did you get a sense of why Madison is on the federal government's list?
Every city in the United States that has a population over 200,000 and an airport is on the list.
Hmm. So there has been opposition from locals in some of the places that are being considered, some elected officials elsewhere. What is your response?
Well, first of all, for those who are worried that it becomes a burden on the community, there's no local burdens in terms of government, in terms of schools, in terms of the county. And in terms of humanitarian treatment for these kids, it's the right thing to do.
We had Senator Ron Johnson on the show yesterday. He had concerns that setting up these housing facilities around the country, A, sends a message that you know, people will be well taken care of and they should migrate from Central America. And second, he raised health concerns that disease might be brought into communities by these migrants. What do you say to those concerns?
First of all, every one of the children, among other things, goes through a routine and thorough health exam, and so that should not be a concern. And secondly, I have a hard time grasping the notion that it's in our interest to treat these kids miserably for the purpose of sending a message. I doubt whether these kids are miserable or in humane surroundings is going to have a profound impact one way or another on attempts to illegally enter the United States. On the other hand, for these children, and these are children, they are without parents, they are without family, the damage that's being done to them, this is really not right.
There's an ongoing conversation around the country and here in Madison about difficulties for poor people in this country already, minority members in our communities, an argument that says we'd love to help these kids coming in, but we barely have the resources to take care of our own here at home.
Well, there's no question, but it's not an either-or proposition. Unfortunately, for better or worse, if we, in effect, turn these children down and we don't do this, the Ron Johnsons of the world aren't doing anything to improve the quality of life, the investment we need to make for the millions of children in this country who are living in poverty.
Where are you in looking for a facility that might fit the needs here?
Well, it's been a little bit of a frustration because the situation in Madison to date is that when we look at all the criteria, 90,000 square feet in the city of Madison, a freestanding building in which a security fence can be put around the facility, when we look at all those criteria, we don't have a qualifying building at this point.
Is there a possibility of going to a neighboring community and Madison participating somehow?
Madison's only participation is locating the building within our borders. So if there's another community, that's up to them. But again, remember, it's got to be a city of 200,000 and an airport.
All right. Mayor Soglin, thanks a lot for joining
us
today.
Bye.
That was Madison Mayor Paul Soglin. I spoke to him earlier today. Alan Gomez, immigration reporter at USA Today, sticks with us. Coming up, we'll hear from Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett talking about U.S. efforts to find temporary housing for some of the 57,000 young Central American migrants taken into custody at the border with Mexico. Madison, Milwaukee have gotten calls to see if they can find a site, as we just heard from Mayor Soglin. You can join the show at 800-642-1234. Do you think Madison and Milwaukee, if they can find a facility, should house some of these migrants temporarily? 800-642-1234 is the number. You can always post on the Central Time Facebook page as well. Continue the conversation, maybe take your call after the news from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. We're speaking with USA Today immigration reporter Alan Gomez about the prospect of communities around the U.S. temporarily housing some of the 50,000-plus young migrants, mostly from Central America, in custody on the U.S.-Mexican border. We heard from Madison Mayor Paul Soglin. Coming up, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett will join us. Both cities have been asked to find a place if they can. You can join in with your thoughts on this at 800-642-1234. Would you be open to housing these migrants in your community? Or do you support sending them back where they came from as quickly as possible? 800-642-1234 is the number. Donna is with us now in Madison. Donna, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm just wondering, I'm from Madison, I live near Central Wisconsin County, which is rumored to be way, way underutilized, and they have beds, and they have the building, and they've got a beautiful green area for children to play in, and there's a huge community of senior citizens that I'm sure all of us would be willing to help out to take care of them, and the only problem is that happens to be a state building, so is there any chance of working with the state and the city of Madison to utilize something like that?
Donna, thanks for the call. And Alan also, so she's describing one possible facility. Mayor Soglin of Madison was describing the difficulty in finding a place that meets all the requirements. Is HHS making it too hard to find a site?
I don't know if it's that they're making it too hard, but it's just that there are certain requirements that they have to meet to have housing that can accommodate children adequately. And I can tell you that it's absolutely not just federal property that they're looking at. State property is also an option. Private property is an option. They're looking at either leasing or renting or in some cases purchasing some locations for these kids. But it is just it's a very long list of requirements that these places have to have. And it's really done just to ensure that these kids are being kept in a safe place, that they're not exposed or, you know, they're not vulnerable to kind of people wandering through, or that it's a secure facility. So it really does need a lot of checks have to be crossed off before they can go ahead and secure these places.
And how about the notion that it has to be a city bigger than 200,000, Mayor Soglin was saying earlier, with an airport? Those are key requirements?
I mean, obviously the airport's a very key requirement because these kids, as they, you know, it's not like they're going to end up being absorbed in that community. These kids are going to be housed there for some period. At some point, the expectation is they're either going to be sent back home to their home country, or they're going to identify places within the United States to be able to house them, be it a relative or foster care or something like that. And so I think having the airport there is just one of those components where they can quickly kind of move people in and out. So I know the airport's an important part. And I think when you look at the size of the community, I think it's just easier when they're scouring the country to identify kind of empty or surplus facilities. That's just when they're doing a national search, I think it just makes it a little bit easier to identify these places in some of the bigger cities around the country.
Back to our callers now with Daryl in Appleton. Daryl, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I side with what Pope Francis said regarding the issue of the children coming across the border, and that we should welcome them and we should protect them. I think some people should put their money where their mouth is. Where are the Christian conservatives? Where are the pro-life people? Oh, that's right. Once you're out of the womb, they just don't care anymore.
Daryl, thanks for the call. Daryl saying, yes, take them in. But, Alan, we've seen a response around the country, protests in some proposed sites, maybe steering local governments away from wanting to participate.
Yeah, and I think that's a bit of the fear. I mean, I've been covering immigration for quite a while now, and I can tell you that it's easy to get a lot of sort of immigration advocates, a lot of immigrants, a lot of people who think that they should be coming here to kind of rally together, to have a march in Washington, to do demonstrations around the country. But I haven't, in all my years doing this, I haven't really seen a lot of demonstrations sort of against the idea of immigrants. And so this is something that's been relatively new, and I think it's catching a lot of people off guard. I can tell you this weekend, there's just even more events planned around the country to oppose and to this rush of kids coming across the border. And I think, obviously that's kind of freaking out a lot of politicians who may have considered maybe opening that community's doors to these kids.
Well, the key phrase there was around the country. When I think of protests against immigration, I think of places along the border. This idea of housing kids around the country seems to be leading to protests around the country away from where you might expect them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you do see those protests, I mean, we're all familiar with sort of the Minutemen that are along the border who try to, sort of vigilantes that try to kind of guard against people getting into the country. And these communities that are usually the ones that are most directly affected by illegal immigration along the border, that's where you usually see that sentiment and where you feel it. And it's strictly because of this idea that we're now kind of spreading these kids out around the country that is kind of catching a lot of people off guard. It's interesting because there are undocumented immigrants that are shipped to prison facilities, to detention facilities all around the country already. It just hasn't gotten the attention that it has until now, because of the incredibly unique nature of this rush of immigrants. We have prison facilities for adults. We have detention facilities. We have immigration and customs courts and things like that around the country where we can send them to. So that just happens every day. Nobody really notices that it's happening. But because there's so many kids and so many of them that are, I mean, younger than 10, younger than 5, so many of those, that's why we're having to kind of scour the country for these facilities. And that's what sort of raised the alert to a lot of people who don't want that around there. So that's going to help kind of speed up this coalescing of people who are getting together to oppose this.
We're talking about immigration right now. We've got USA Today immigration reporter Alan Gomez with us. Earlier, we talked to Madison Mayor Paul Soglin. I know we've got Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett. Both of those cities are being asked potentially to take in some of the migrants on the border for a limited period of time. Mayor Tom Barrett, thanks for joining us again.
I'm happy to join you.
So have you gotten some kind of official request from the federal government to take in some of these migrants on the border?
We've had conversations with representatives of the federal government. We're going to have a further follow-up call tomorrow. And what we're trying to do here is there has been outreach to a number of different entities. There's been an outreach to the city, to Milwaukee County, to Milwaukee Public Schools, to Catholic Charities, to Voces de la Frontera. And we thought it made sense for us to have a conversation with the Department of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Falk in particular, as to what the needs are, what the expectations are, what the timetable is, what the costs are, reimbursement. And because it's a pressing matter, we wanted to do that as quickly as possible.
Are you at the stage where you're looking for potential facilities already?
Certainly the conversations have begun as to whether facilities would be available. It has gone no further than that whatsoever.
There have been elected officials around the country reacting, in some cases positively, in some cases very negatively, saying they don't want this to happen in their community. As the mayor of Milwaukee, what do you think? Is this a good idea?
I think this is a humanitarian crisis. I think that there are a lot of young people who, through no fault of their own, have been displaced. And I think the right thing for us to do is to make sure that they are in a safe and healthy environment until the legal issues are resolved, and then the final decision is made as to where they will go.
And have you heard response from citizens yet? This has gotten a lot of attention already. Are you hearing pro-con from residents?
I have not heard anybody who objected to it. I have had not many people, but the people who understand what's going on, I think, are very sympathetic given the humanitarian crisis and the fact that many times these are very young children, some of them are teenagers, who are less sympathetic to some people. But certainly there are some very young children that are involved. And I do think it's a question of health and safety to make sure that they are in a safe place.
I know you mentioned a meeting tomorrow. Do you have a timeline if everything goes through when
this would
happen?
No, we'll have more information. Tomorrow's a phone conversation. And I think this is very fluid. Obviously, the president has made a request to Congress for resources for this and has been at least initially rebuffed by some in the Republican leadership. And I think whether it's Milwaukee or Madison or other communities around the state or country, I think one of the issues is going to be who bears the cost, that this is something that is clearly a national issue, not a local issue. And I think that there would be a much different reaction if local taxpayers in any community were being asked to pay a large portion of this or even a significant or small portion of this. But given that if there's a recognition at the national level that this deserves a national response, then I think it is incumbent upon us to see what we can do, again, from a humanitarian standpoint.
Mayor Barrett, thanks for joining us.
All right. Thank you very much.
That's Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett. Still with us now, Alan Gomez with USA Today. So, Mayor Barrett, talking about how costs will be handled. Is this something that if a city says, yes, go for it, we've got a spot, the federal government picks up the whole price tag? Alan?
I mean, that's exactly how it's supposed to be working right now. And he was absolutely right, the mayor, and what he was saying is that there's just this week there's been quite a lot of blowback from Republicans about the size of this request. I think I mentioned it's a $3.7 billion overall request. $1.8 billion of that, a little bit more than the majority of it, is specifically for this problem that we're talking about and trying to identify these places to house them. The expectation is not that all these local communities are going to suddenly have to start feeding and caring for all these kids. That's why that price tag is as high as it is, because they're trying to identify places around the country, and the federal government is going to pay for that. I mean, there's a 2008 law that requires the Department of Health and Homeland Security of Health and Human Services, to take care of these kids until they find them some more permanent housing. So this is completely incumbent on the federal government, and the only cost that could eventually get to a local community is if that kid ends up being adopted or fostered or housed by somebody in that community and then starts maybe going to public school or going to hospitals or things like that. That would be the only thing, and that would be way down the road.
Alan, as always, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That was USA Today immigration reporter Alan Gomez. We've been talking about the prospect of communities around the U.S. and here in Wisconsin taking in some of the 57,000 young migrants in temporary facilities. We talked also to Madison Mayor Paul Soglin, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett. Time to share something cool with you. Today it is books. Vacation reading season is here again, and so is Steve Paulson. He's one of our resident book addicts here at WPR. He's executive producer of WPR's To the Best of Our Knowledge. Steve, welcome back.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Well, you've got some great variety for us. A sociological study of inner city life, an exploration of the limits of science, and a novel set in Italy. Take us to Italy first.
That is right. Yeah. Well, one of the things that I love about literature from other countries is that you get a glimpse of another culture, mm-hmm. Of another way of life that you really don't know that much about. And that's certainly true with the book that I have here. It's by Elena Ferrante. The book is called My Brilliant Friend. It's actually the first of a trilogy about life in Naples, Italy, starting in about the 1950s or so. And this is, she writes about kind of these hard scrabble lives of bakers and carpenters and vegetable sellers. And I mean, they're poor. There's a fair amount of violence in these lives. Sort of extends down to the level of the street children. And the title, My Brilliant Friend, refers to, it's basically the story about this very intense friendship between these two girls who are, they're both really, they're the brightest girls in their class. And this is an era, Italy, Naples, 1950s, when, being smart and a girl doesn't really get you very far. Mm. So it's sort of partly dealing with all of that. And, the friend of the narrator, this girl named Lila, is sort of this feral child, sort of wild, powerful, intense, and but kind of limited by her life circumstances. And so it takes you there sort of very viscerally.
It sounds like it's rich in details about these two characters,
yes,
but also about this place and a very specific time.
Right,
in
exactly.
Italian history.
Yes, yes. And also, I mean, there's a backstory about the author as well. So Elena Ferrante is, she's a very well-known literary figure in Italy, except for no one knows anything about her. She's sort of like the Thomas Pynchon of Italian letters.
Really?
So it's assumed this is a pseudonym. This is not really her real name. I mean, no one knows what she looks like. No one knows where she lives now. There's even been speculation that it might actually be a man writing these books, although unlikely it would seem because the details are so vivid about sort of growing up as a girl in Italy. And so it's just sort of, there's this whole mystery, this intrigue about these books. And I think they're just starting to catch on in the United States.
I didn't ask you before the show. Do you have a reading for us?
I do. Yeah, I could pull out. Yes. Let me read you a little bit.
Yeah, give
from,
us a taste of the
yes,
feel.
Yes, right,
of it.
Right near the beginning of it. She says. So she's the narrator is writing this as an old woman reflecting back on her life, and she says, "My friendship with Lila began the day we decided to go up the dark stairs that led, step after step, flight after flight, to the door of Don Achille's apartment. I remember the violet light of the courtyard, the smells of a warm spring evening. The mothers were making dinner. It was time to go home, but we delayed, challenging each other without ever saying a word, testing our courage. For some time, in school and outside of it, that was what we'd been doing. Lila would thrust her hand and then her whole arm into the black mouth of a manhole, and I, in turn, immediately did the same. My heart pounding, hoping that the cockroaches wouldn't run over my skin, that the rats wouldn't bite me. Lila climbed up to Signora Spagnuolo's ground floor window, and hanging from the iron bar that the clothesline was attached to, swung back and forth, then lowered herself down to the sidewalk, and I immediately did the same, although I was afraid of falling and hurting myself. Lila stuck into her skin the rusted safety pin that she'd found on the street somewhere, but kept it in her pocket like the gift of a fairy godmother. I watched the metal point as it dug a whitish tunnel into her palm, and then, when she pulled it out and handed it to me, I did the same."
Wow. Well, can I nominate you to do a chapter a day on that? That was great reading and such vivid writing.
It is. It definitely takes you there.
And this is going to be a trilogy, but I gather it's intended as it's not a cliffhanger. This is one whole
story. Yeah, and I believe the second volume has also been has come out in the U.S. Has been translated, and I think the third is soon to be published in the United States.
So it's Elena Ferrante, and the title is My Brilliant Friend.
Right. Yes.
Well, it sounds amazing. Well, let's move on to one. We've actually had the author on the show, Alice Goffman, and her study of inner city life. We talked about her research some. Talk about the book.
Yeah. Well, the book has just come out, and it's fascinating. And Alice Goffman is she just moved to Madison, is an assistant professor here of sociology at the UW-Madison. And it's the story of life in the inner city, and particularly in this particular neighborhood in Philadelphia, predominantly black neighborhood, and especially the lives of these young men who are, I mean, again, it's another hardscrabble story. I mean, these are men who have extremely limited life options. So, I mean, they're often dealing with a sort of small scale drug dealing. There's a fair amount of crime. They're kind of in and out of the criminal justice system. I mean, part of what she's doing here is she's showing how the war on drugs has been devastating, particularly to the African American community. They've often been targeted. And the reason why the book is called On the Run is these guys are they're on the run from the police. The police are often looking for them. They're often suspects in crimes that have been reported, which they may or may not have been done. But to the point where even if they have gunshot wounds, they avoid hospitals because they know the police are often hanging out there, sort of waiting for them to. For possible suspects to show up. So it's a very gritty story. And again, there's another interesting backstory here.
Right. So this is a sociologist. A lot of times I think of a sociologist doing their survey, crunching the numbers. That's not how she did this.
No. So she's an ethnographer who sort of follows in the long tradition of participant observation. And there's a fascinating story here. So she comes from a privileged background. She's white. She grew up in Philadelphia, but a completely different neighborhood than this. She went off to an Ivy League school, University of Pennsylvania. She sort of came on this subject. This is something that she wanted to write about for her college thesis. She ended up moving for 6 years into this neighborhood that she was writing about, became very close friends with three of these guys, and to the point where her old life and kind of the normal academic life you'd have as a college student and kind of disappeared. She sort of stopped hanging out with those people. She spent all of her time in this neighborhood. She kind, you know, there's this sort of fascinating dynamic between, you know, race, class, privilege. She learned to sort of talk in a different way, dress in a different way. These became her closest friends. She witnessed shootings, killings, beatings. The whole thing was, it's very gripping. It's sort of a remarkable feat of reporting.
And do you have a reading on this one? Some of the language was strong.
It is strong. I don't have a particular reading in mind here.
But it's an amazing story. It's gotten some controversy over that. Some of the ethics behind it. I mean, she's there. She's witnessing crimes.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And the story is that she, as soon as she finished her research, she apparently burned her research notes because she didn't want to, you know, be subpoenaed.
Wow.
And say, you know, okay, you have to. So there is the, you know. Is this okay for an academic to be witnessing these things and just sort of, you know, not reporting them to the authorities?
Well, from gritty life in the city, you take us to the limits of science. And I got to say, just before I saw your list today, I saw something about this book and I thought, this sounds like a Steve Paulson kind of book right here.
It's right up my alley.
Marcelo Gleiser, tell us about
him. Well, Marcelo, he's a physicist at Dartmouth College. And for those of our listeners who may look at the NPR science blog, 13.7, he's one of the founders of that. So he writes regularly there. And so he's very good at writing for a popular audience. And so this is really a story about scientific humility. And, you know, because, I mean, you think about it, we're in a lot of ways, we're living in this golden age of physics, of science. You know, we've learned all of these new things about sort of the age of the universe, the shape of the universe, and all of that. And Gleiser is saying, you know, we're limited in what – if we think we know reality, I mean, that's a fool's errand. He says, you know, we're limited by the instruments that we have. You know, so, for instance, the telescope and the microscope opened up new worlds. But we kind of can only know the world through these instruments.
And it's not just that there are things we don't know yet, right? It's that there are things we're probably never going to know.
We're limited by the instruments we have. We're limited also by some facts of nature. For instance, we know that the universe was born roughly 13.8 billion years ago, started then. We can only see as far as light can travel during that time. For all we know, the universe might go on forever. It might be infinite, but we probably would never know that. There are all kinds of other things. The multiverse, you know, this theory that there are many universes probably is untestable. And so he's really saying there's profound mystery there, and he finds that inspiring. He thinks that that's the thing that sort of makes it interesting, that we'll kind of never know sort of really the root nature of reality, even though we may think we do.
And even though he's a scientist, you might think that would be discouraging. He's not.
He is not. No, he finds this very inspiring. He says, you know, this is not defeatism. This is not anti-science. This is kind of the impulse that drives a lot of scientists to, we may ask questions that we never know answers to, but that's fine. I mean, that's what keeps us going. That's kind of what makes us human in a way.
We've brought us some great books that I'm sure are going to raise a lot of good questions, if not provide answers. Steve, as always, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks.
That's Steve Paulson. He's executive director of To the Best of Our Knowledge. We bring him on every month to share some awesome reads for you.